The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the New York Times. First of all, an article published by the Religion News Service on June the 30th and written by Bob Smetana, entitled, Southern Baptists Lose Another Megachurch. Elevation Church Quits the SBC. A North Carolina megachurch known for its popular music and charismatic pastor has left the Southern Baptist Convention. In a letter sent to the SBC's executive committee in Nashville and to the Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, Charlotte-based Elevation Church said it was withdrawing its affiliation with the Southern Baptist Convention, effective immediately. The letter was published by Baptist Press, an official SBC publication. A spokesman for the North Carolina Baptist Convention confirmed receiving the letter. We have no plans to make a public announcement on this decision. We have too much to do in reaching a world that needs the love of Jesus, the letter reads. Should your credentials committee decide to make this decision by Elevation public, we will only respond with a copy of this letter to anyone inquiring about the notification. Elevation did not respond to a request for a comment. The SBC's credentials committee is charged with determining if churches are in friendly cooperation with the nation's largest Protestant denomination. That cooperation includes giving to SBC causes and closely following the SBC's doctrine. Earlier this year, five congregations, including Saddleback Church, which is one of the largest SBC churches in the country, were expelled from the SBC for having women pastors. The SBC's statement of faith says only men can hold that office. At a recent annual meeting, Southern Baptist passed a proposed constitutional amendment that would bar churches that have women pastors of any kind. That amendment must be ratified in 2024. By some estimates, about 2,000 SBC churches have women serving in pastoral roles, including supporting roles like associate pastors, children's pastors, and music ministers. Elevation's letter gives no reason for the church's departure after more than two decades in the SBC. However, Holly Furtick, wife of Elevation pastor Stephen Furtick, is described as a church co-founder and preaches on a regular basis. A number of SBC leaders, including prominent seminary president Albert L. Moeller, believe the Bible bars women from preaching in worship services. According to data submitted by the church to the SBC, Elevation averaged 10,185 attendees each week and had a $103 million in donations for 2021. The church gave $10,000 to the SBC's cooperative program. A recent study found that Elevation is one of four megachurches whose songs dominate the market for contemporary worship music. Ryan Burge, a political scientist from Eastern Illinois University, noted that Saddleback Church and Elevation, which reportedly baptized 1,725 people in 2021, accounted for about 2.5% of the baptisms for the entire SBC, which has more than 40,000 churches. The SBC has seen declining baptism and membership numbers for more than a decade. The SBC lost nearly 500,000 members from 2021 to 2022, and 1.5 million in the last 3 years. In 2022, the SBC reported 13.2 million members, down from 16.3 million in 2006. Despite leaving the SBC, Elevation plans to keep partnering with Southern Baptist churches. Chunks Corbett, a leader at Elevation, wrote, "Please know that our withdrawal from affiliation in no way means that we will withdraw from praying for you and your ministries and mission work in the future. We are all on the same side. Our next article was published by Religion News Service on June 28, written by Claire Giangrave, and entitled, Gamer and Programmer Carlo Acutis Could Be the Right Saint for Gen Z, New Book Argues. Vatican City. In a new book, Blessed Carlos Acutis, A Saint in Sneakers, Vatican journalist Courtney Mayers tells the story of how an average 90s kid who loved computers ended up on the path to sainthood and how his life inspires Catholics in today's digital age. In life, Acutis combined a profound devotion for the Eucharist, which he described as his highway to heaven, with a sincere passion for computers and video games. He died of leukemia in 2006 at age 15, but his death sent ripples through the community that surrounded him and beyond. Pope Francis made Acutis blessed, a first step toward sainthood in the Catholic Church in October 2020. As a computer programming millennial on the path to sainthood, Carlos has shown that Apple computers, Spider-Man comics, and Super Mario on Nintendo 64, and a life of heroic virtue are not mutually exclusive, said Mayers, answering questions by RNS via email. Mayers said she was drawn to Acutis' story because of how it showcased holiness in the 21st century. Carlo's story challenges us, not because he was crucified upside down or burned alive or shipwrecked on a missionary journey, but precisely because he lived a life of heroic virtue. By living a relatively normal life for a kid in the 1990s and early 2000s, she added. In the book, Mayers talks about Acutis' popularity going viral after his death. With his name being Googled more often at the time of his beatification than that of Pope Francis, Acutis' life inspired a video game developer in seeking to create a game that attempts to immerse players in the lives of saints. Mayers also said she has heard of Catholics asking for Acutis' intercession when facing an IT issue. Nicknamed God's Influencer, the Italian teen has garnered attention all over the world, from Australia to Latin America. Catholic buildings and activities are being named after him. In the Philippines, 36,000 people tuned in on Facebook to watch a procession honoring his birth. Acutis is the official patron of the upcoming World Youth Day in Lisbon, Portugal, this July, where Pope Francis will be in attendance. According to the author, it will ensure that even more young people from around the world can hear his story for the first time and be inspired by his witness. While Mayer said there is no official news yet regarding Acutis' sainthood cause, an investigation into an alleged miracle is underway in the Diocese of Florence. A miracle attributed to Acutis was recognized in 2020 when a six-year-old boy suffering from a rare genetic pancreatic disease was suddenly healed after praying to Acutis. A second miracle needs to be recognized for Acutis to be given a halo. The book shows how Acutis strived toward holiness not only through great gestures, but also by practicing small acts of faith, from helping out in his community to going to daily Mass and sharing his beliefs with others. It also showcases how Acutis avoided some of the trappings of modern technology by remembering to put other people and his faith first. Acutis died before the launch of the iPhone or TikTok's rise in popularity, Mayer said, and barely lived to see the first ever cat video uploaded to the internet. But as a saint, he can be an inspiration for Catholics seeking a way to use these technologies for good, she added. In a chapter called What Carlo Can Teach Gen Z, the book cites studies showing how many adolescents today who are exposed to the digital world suffer from depression and have suicidal thoughts. Carlo Acutis loved computers, but he did not lose himself in an online world, spending all day gaming without leaving the house. He remained firmly planted through his daily interactions with other people and the sacraments, Mayer said. Acutis had a strong fascination with the sacrament of the Eucharist, which Catholics believe the real presence of Jesus is felt. Acutis chased evidence of Eucharistic miracles, which he believed would lead lapsed Catholics to return to Mass, Mayer explained. He was fascinated by reported cases in the Italian town of Lanciano or in Buenos Aires of the Eucharist turning into flesh and sought scientific evidence for these miracles. U.S. bishops chose Acutis to be the patron of the Eucharistic Revival Initiative to raise awareness, understanding, and enthusiasm for the sacrament. The teen can also be an inspiration for those who face suffering and pain in life, Mayer said. Despite dying at such a young age, he was ready to go. He had lived his life for God and understood that death was not a moment to be dreaded, but a moment to surrender all to Jesus, she said. Over the course of 5 years, Mayer has conducted dozens of interviews with not only friends and relatives of Acutis, but also with many whose lives were touched by his example. One woman in the United States spoke about how the young saint inspired her after she was diagnosed with breast cancer, leading her to visit his tomb in the Italian town of Assisi, which is also the resting place of the famous Saint Francis. Mayer hopes more people will pray to Acutis, with one more miracle attributed to his intercession approved by the Vatican. The Catholic Church will have its first computer coding saint, she said. Now an article from the New York Times, published on June 28, written by Jessica Groves, entitled, What Churches Offer That Nuns Still Long For. I started this series because I felt that the rise of nuns, Americans who say they have no formal religious affiliation, was one of the biggest, most complicated, and most misunderstood changes in society in the past half century. And my sense was that the subject had been discussed mostly among people who had strong polarizing opinions about the change, either atheists who cheered at it or the religiously observant who decried it. As I started my reporting, my own feelings about the rise of nuns were somewhat ambivalent. I'm Jewish and still have a strong cultural identity, but I'm not observant. I don't miss shul and have little desire to return, yet I feel a bit heartsick about not passing down Jewish rituals with more consistency for my children. After months of reading about this massive change and having had quite a few deep and very moving conversations with some of the over 7,000 readers who responded to my initial call out about becoming less religious over time, the one aspect of religion in America that I unquestionably see as an overall positive for society is the ready-made supportive community that churchgoers can access. When I say churchgoers, of course I mean those who attend a church, temple, mosque, gurdwara, friends meeting, or any of the many traditional houses of worship in America. The idea of community connects them all. Community was mentioned in over 2,300 reader responses. As the reader Julie Prado, 50, from Washington State, wrote to me, I was raised Pentecostal and went to church 3 or more times a week, so I desperately miss the community. It was where my friendships came from. I have very few friends now. Prado told me, she isn't part of a church because she hasn't found one that fully affirms gay people or believes as strongly as she does in the separation of church and state. I have joined groups that are fighting for these things, she said, like Christians Against Christian Nationalism, but they don't provide the same kind of social fabric that her church did. I asked every sociologist I interviewed whether communities created around secular activities, outside of houses of worship, could give the same level of wraparound support that churches, temples, and mosques are able to offer. Nearly across the board, the answer was no. Phil Zuckerman, a professor of sociology and secular studies at Pfizer College, put it this way. I can go play soccer on a Sunday morning and hang out with different people from different races and different class backgrounds, and we can bond. But I'm not doing that with my grandparents and my grandchildren. A soccer team can't provide spiritual solace in the face of death. It probably doesn't have a weekly charitable call, and there's no sense of connection to a heritage that goes back generations. You can get bits and pieces of these disparate qualities elsewhere, he said, but there's no one-stop shop, at least not right now. That doesn't mean Americans can't or don't cobble together their own support networks and senses of meaning without organized religion. Clearly, many do. But the group of Americans who are moving away from religion in the most significant percentages may have the hardest time building community from scratch because they are often shortest on time and resources. As I noted in part 4 of this series, every demographic group in the United States is becoming less religious. But groups that are overrepresented among people with no religion in particular are those without high school diplomas, who are single, who don't have children, and who earn less than $50,000 a year. This trend complicates, if not contradicts, the commonly held notion that religion is most deeply rooted among everyday working Americans and less among the chattering class. But as Ryan Burge explains in The Nuns, Where They Come From, Who They Are, and Where They Are Going, data from the Comprehensive Cooperative Election Study show that in America, those with the lowest level of education are more likely to say that they have no religious affiliation than those with the highest level of education. In his book, Burge, a pastor and a political scientist at Eastern Illinois University, disaggregates the umbrella category of nuns into three groups: atheists, agnostics, and nothing in particulars. Atheists believe there is no God. Agnostics are open to the possibility, but not convinced that God or gods exist. And nothing in particulars don't align themselves with any specific faith tradition. And Burge has a helpful way of roughing out the terrain. If all the nuns were represented by just five people, one of them would be an atheist, another one would be agnostic, and three of them would be nothing in particulars. He writes that 32% of those who did not earn a high school diploma identified as nuns, the highest percentage of any educational level. And while half of the overall population of the United States earns less than $50,000 per year in household income, 60% of the nothing in particulars earn less. He notes that nothing in particulars are one of the most educationally and economically disadvantaged groups in the United States today, while atheists and agnostics enjoy much higher levels of economic success. What this suggests to me and to the scholars I've spoken to over the past few months is that there's a substantial group of Americans who are grappling with societal pressures on multiple fronts. Americans who are further down the socioeconomic ladder are lonelier than their more economically well-off counterparts. Americans with lower levels of education have higher mortality rates. And those are some of the same Americans who are alienated from religious institutions, even if many of them still believe in God. As the authors of The Great De-Churching, Who's Leaving, Why They Are Going, and What Will It Take to Bring Them Back, all of whom are pastors, write, in our opinion, America is largely built for a specific type of person. If you belong to a nuclear family, graduate from college, and have children after marriage, America's institutions tend to work better for you. If you get off that track or never started on it, the U.S. is a more difficult place in which to thrive. They go on to say that church culture can feel unwelcoming and even shaming to people who are struggling financially or have family structures outside of the model they describe. What's more, they write, modern American churches are financially incentivized to target the wealthy and create a space where those on track feel comfortable. Biblical hospitality, though, is so much more than just throwing money at a problem. And the net result is that the average American church is not truly hospitable to the less fortunate, making them feel like outsiders in our midst. Many readers who replied to my query mentioned leaving churches that rejected them during their divorces. Others talked about being constantly hit up for money they couldn't afford to donate. I'd like to see faith communities do a better job of including people who aren't on that, if you will, ordained track. Not because I think people need to be religious to live good lives, I don't believe that, but because almost everyone needs community to flourish. As the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, whom I spoke to for this series and who wrote Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, has been preaching for decades, increasing social isolation is bad for all of us. As Carson Curtis, 36, who lives in Arizona, wrote about missing a general sense of community from attending church, being socially atomized is hard on the spirit. Burge told me a story about his church that illustrated organized religion at its best. He described a section of the service where they asked for prayers of the people, where members of the congregation would describe a tough situation and ask for prayers. A young man, probably in his early 20s with a baby, said he had just lost his job and wouldn't make rent that month and asked if the congregation would pray for him. Birch said an older gentleman in the congregation went up to the young man after the service and said, "Son, if you need a job, you can come work for me tomorrow." While that might sound like a scene from a Frank Capra movie, church really does wind up being one of the few places that people from different walks of life can interact with and help one another. At the same time, examples of that kind of grace don't erase the damage that is sometimes done in the name of religion. Americans of all backgrounds are clearly in the midst of a profound shift away from trusting many different kinds of institutions beyond just religious ones. And sometimes there are good reasons behind this lack of trust. There's a lot of pain and alienation fueling many people's rejections of their religious upbringings. I've heard so many stories of racial prejudice, misogyny, and outright abuse over the course of my reporting. That is a betrayal and a failure. The shift is ongoing and gaining speed. After talking to readers searching for fresh answers to life's eternal questions, I believe that there is potential for new kinds of meaningful, lasting communities to be created in the coming years that have nothing to do with organized religion as we know it. I'm eager to see what comes next because I believe that out of this evolution, Americans can create something nurturing that is also suited to modern life. Our last article is an excerpt from one published by the Religion News Service on July the 3rd and written by Emily McFarland Miller. It's entitled, UCC Elects First Woman and First Woman of African Descent to Lead Denomination. The United Church of Christ elected its first female general minister and president on July 3 at its 34th General Synod in Indianapolis. The Reverend Karen Georgia Thompson's election also makes her the first woman of African descent to lead the mainline denomination. Today, United Church of Christ, we created a first together. It won't be the last first, Thompson, dressed in white, told delegates afterward. Those delegates overwhelmingly approved Thompson's nomination to a four-year term as general minister and president of the UCC. Breaking into song and applause as the results of the vote, 626 yeses to 43 noes, were announced. Thompson is the third woman to be nominated to lead the UCC, which celebrated its 66th anniversary days before General Synod began. While neither the Reverend Yvonne Delk, nominated in 1989, nor the Reverend Barbara Brown Zickman, 1999, ultimately were elected to lead the denomination, Thompson said during her speech, their ministries have individually and collectively shaped the UCC and paved the way for women to serve in ministry in the UCC, opening wide the doors of this denomination. That Thompson is the first woman to lead the denomination may be surprising to some, given the denomination's progressive stances on women's rights and many other issues. For instance, General Synod attendees took part in a prayer walk on July 1 to the Indiana State Capitol to protest legislative efforts to ban gender-affirming care and restrict abortion services. Delegates also are expected to vote on resolutions expressing support for reparations for African Americans, calling on local churches to declare themselves white supremacy-free zones, and launching a study of the denomination's relationships with boarding schools that separated generations of indigenous children from their families and cultures in the U.S. I want to hold value to the moment and to what it has taken to get to this place because, as I've said before, it's not just me. There are others who came before me, and perhaps this is a right time for the denomination, Thompson told RNS before the vote by delegates to the biennial meeting. I think when we talk about being progressive, we need to remember our own history, that this has been tried and done and without success. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.